Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First this morning, it's competition time, and I've got tickets for you to see the one and only Cher. She was last in Ireland 15 years ago, but she's going to perform at Dublin's Three Arena on Friday, the 1st of November. Well, for a chance of winning a pair of tickets, all you need to do this morning is answer this simple question. Finish the title of this Cher hit. If I could turn back, is it time? Or home. Text your answer A or B and your name to 51551 and I'll announce the winner before the end of today's show and you'll be heading off to see Cher. We're going to start now with some live music and I really like in the show that we give a chance to new emerging Irish talent and this young woman was very much one of the biggest hits of the recent Trad Fest in Dublin. It's Susan O'Neill, known to many as Sun as well. So I'll chat to you in a moment, Susan, but before that, take it away. You're going to sing your own song, Found Myself Lost.
Well, I found myself lost in the woods. Found myself there every day. Fell on some sense to my expense. I'm here and nobody knows. Dress it was dirty and torn, like the smile I was wearing around. The leaves bashed and cried, applauding my pride. I'm here, I'm not going home.
Like birds, love them, rate them, you say what. what you'll say, but I'll tell these feet where to go. Over my shoulder I won't look over, I'll sharpen my words and release them like birds. Love them or hate them, you'll say what you'll say, but I'll tell these feet where to go. I tell these feet where to go. I tell these feet. I tell these feet where to go.
Well, Susan, I'm not surprised to hear that you were the standout hit of the recent Tradfest in Dublin. Come down and sit here with me. You began your career as a writer. Well, you began your career in Ennis,
in
a gospel choir.
With the brass band and the gospel choir, So kind of two very different outlets for a teenager to express, music through the body. And that's kind of...
And you also say you're an ad for your parents being quite strict because they didn't let you out much, so...
Yes, my mum used to always say, "You'll thank me when you're older." And I said, "No, I won't." And, lo and behold, a couple of years ago, by the way, mum, thank you.
Fantastic. And listen, is it true you're off on a 6-week tour of Australia and New Zealand with the great Sharon Shannon?
Yes. Oh, I'm very much looking forward to that. So we're going on Wednesday morning and we're going to go around Australia. I was there last year, but I did a solo tour, so this year to go with herself, and she's an amazing band. Sean Regan and Jack Maher and Jim Murray, and so to play with all of them and to do a little bit of New Zealand and Australia is just a treat, really.
And the people of Cork are lucky as well. Are you doing a concert on May the 10th there?
Yes, I'm playing at It Takes a Village in Trebolgan on May the 10th, so... I haven't actually been to that festival yet. So.
Yeah, no, it's great. The lovely thing is, because just for my listeners, you did everything there yourself. Because sometimes I have, singers and they'll have different people accompany them, but you just did that all yourself. You're like very much a one-woman orchestra.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mad thing. It's great to do because...
Tell them what you were doing, actually. I was mesmerised by what you were doing.
So it's a loop pedal and it allows me to record... The beat, it allows me to record everything I'm doing live, and then it plays it back and repeats it over and over, and I can layer on top of it until it just becomes a whole big wall of sound.
It's amazing, actually, yeah.
It's good fun, but anytime I'm playing a show, I'll play a little bit to show everybody what I'm doing. I'll do an example and I stop it and say, well, that's why I have no friends.
You did. And also,
I remember
David Kitt recently talking about, sometimes it can be quite hard starting off as a young person in the music industry, but you're obviously finding it okay, are you?
I mean, I've been playing music, and I went to college in Waterford and became acquainted with two different bands. So I sing with two other bands. One is called King Kong Company, and they're a dance and electronic, and another one, Propeller Palms, which are, soul and rock and a little bit of funk. So I was very lucky to be brought along with both of those bands, showing me the industry and how it works from, a whole different perspective. And so you learn, lessons the easy way and the hard way as you go. Mm-hmm. So it can be hard, but I think, anything that you love doing is going to have its tough times, and it's just a matter of how much you're willing to put into it, really.
Well, obviously it's working for you. You're heading to Australia, New Zealand, and you're super talented. Susan O'Neill, thanks so much for being my guest this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Very best of luck in the future. We'll take a break. Fab singer there, says one of our listeners. She sounds like a very young Mary Coughlan. Well, my next guest this morning is multi-talented and multi-faceted. After a long career in academia, Also in the Oireachtas is a member of Fine Gael and the Dáil and the Seanad. He's now president of the Irish Human Rights Commission and also is Chancellor of the National University of Ireland. And he's also chairperson for Our Decade of Centenaries in this country, as well, of course, as history books, novels, and even a potentially life-threatening condition called hemochromatosis. Good morning, Dr. Morris Manning.
Morning, Marianne.
You've fitted a lot into your life.
Yeah, in fact, I'm not in the Human Rights Commission anymore. That's Fine. Long gone. But anyway.
But you were.
I was indeed. Yeah,
yeah. Busy life. Let's go right back. Tell me where you were born and your family.
Well, Bagnallstown, County Carlow, 1943. I was a war baby. I'm the oldest of 10. Thankfully, all of us are still alive. But there was a child virtually every year during my growing up. There was always a baby in the corner. And, it's funny, I'm looking back now, I'm trying to do a bit of writing about where I came from and the people and what Bagnallstown was like. And it was a great place to grow up because you had woods around you, you had the river, the swimming pool, we all learned to swim, you could play tennis, there was all sorts of games there. And no such thing, I mean, keys were left in hall doors, you went out in the morning, you came back in the evening. And I still have, and I have very strong attachments to Bagnallstown. But what I feel a bit annoyed with myself at this stage when I'm trying to write is I didn't ask enough questions. Because my father was a quite extraordinary man with whom I didn't have a great relationship for a good part of my life. We were very friendly in later years. But I think he was a young man with a child arriving every year starting a business. But it's the business that interests me because during the war, very young, just married, and he bought a wood up near Castletown in County Leash. And from that, he made a good living during the war because there was a shortage of supplies and all of that. But then after the war, he bought a disused Russian oil petroleum building in Bagnallstown because the Russians had intended supplying Ireland with oil. And then events like the First World War came along and the revolution and that was shelved. So he bought that building. And at the same time in Glenstall Abbey, the Belgian monks were training a lot of the young local fellas from around Maru and Limerick to be master craftsmen. So he got a few fellas from Maru, from Glenstall, but the woodworking school there. And he started what became a really very successful furniture making business that he was there for the big boom in church building and in schools in the 50s. So he would have supplied the furniture to all of those. And he used to hire Imogen Stewart to do some of the sculpting. Wow. And it was very, very successful. But my problem is I don't know how it all happened, how it evolved, what it was. And there's nobody around to ask questions to anymore about all of that.
And when you say, I suppose like a lot of young men, you had a good relationship at the end of your life, but yes, a trickier one at earlier stages. Yeah, is that a young man, father?
He was very much of his time and they didn't do emotional talking and that sort of thing. And he was a young man. He was very busy. He had to find the wages every week for a big staff, and there was a child born virtually every year. So I think, and I was probably a little bit of a smart ass. And but then time passes and I really began to appreciate him.
Tell me about your mother.
Ah, she was great. lively, irreverent, a really great sense of humour, great common sense. She was the biggest person in my growing up, and I've still got emotional when I think about her.
Oh, that sucks. You just loved your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing what I was thinking. Like, she had 10 children. Like, and you know, probably worked incredibly hard to bring you all up, did she?
She did, but she was a very capable person and she took shortcuts and all that sort of thing as well. She did. And, you know, she told me that when she got married, this priest gave her a book saying by a Dominican called A Dozen Thank God. And he said, that's to be your target. It was crazy stuff. And she really, she was still, my youngest brother is 24 years younger than me. Mm. So it was crazy. And she advised her own daughters never to be caught up in that sort of tyranny.
No, madness. It's amazing you're all still alive, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a good gene pool there of good health.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, 10 of you.
Yeah.
Was it hard being the eldest? People often say if you're the youngest in a family, of a big family, it's easier. And if you're the eldest, is it a hard position or not, eldest of 10?
Well, my wife always says to me that even though I'm the eldest, I have all the characteristics of an only child. And she doesn't say it kindly. So anyway, not really. You're different. There were almost three families in the family. You know, and I went away to boarding school when I was 15. And, you know, then I went to Dublin. And you, in one sense, you grow away from the family because you have all your new interests. On the other hand, you never really grow away from them. You know, when you meet them up, it's as if nothing ever happened. And you can keep talking from where you left off.
Where did Fine Gael come in your family? Was your dad or your mum, were they political?
My father was an old style, what Sean O'Rourke would call Fianna Fáil from East Galway.
Right.
And my mother was very blue. And that was it. And I was just fascinated by just politics itself. And even when I was 11 or 12, I'd be following elections and so on. Of course, there's very little information in those days. There were no chat or current affairs programmes. So it was hard to get information. But no, really, I became involved in politics in boarding school and in when I went to UCD. And I shopped around a little bit. When I was living in Glasgow, I was briefly not a member, but I attended Communist Party meetings, I think largely because I hugely fancied the woman who invited me along, but I couldn't take that. It was much too serious and ideological. I was in the Labour Party for a year when I was living in Glasgow. I think I was briefly a member, but it was Declan Costello, really, and the Just Society, which influenced a lot of people in my generation. And that was hugely... it was a time when Fianna Fáil seemed to be, you know, the party of the builders and of Tacha and all of that sort of thing. And when you're young, you want something clean and pure to follow. And so I found in Declan Costello a great inspiration. And then when Gareth, whom I knew, became leader of Fine Gael, I wrote to him and said, look, I'd love to get into politics. And he did me the great favour of making me a candidate for the European elections, where I lost my deposit. And one of the things, I was always terribly naive about politics. I thought it'd be very easy to get elections, and I was a lecturer in UCD. Surely everybody would know me. Well, they didn't. And I learned very quickly that some of the old hands around the place knew an awful lot more than me. But eventually I was elected. I ran in the 81 election in Dublin North East, where I didn't live, where I knew nobody. And it was the best election I ever fought. A lot of my students came out to work for me, and some very good local people. So I was in the Dáil then for about 7 years and then into the Senate.
Tell us about meeting De Valera.
I was a postgraduate student in the 60s, and I fell in love with this girl from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Fell in love easily in those days. And I had a competitor, and he was a poet. And I couldn't compete with that, so I had to do something fairly dramatic. So I was sitting in Madigan's pub with her one day, and I said, would you like to see the President of Ireland? She said, gee, you couldn't do that. So I got out to the phone, got four pennies, phoned the Auris, very sleepy voice at the other end. Yeah, I said, look, I'm a student of history. I have an American. Would it be possible to meet President De Valera? Ah, yeah, no bother. When would you like to come up? How's tomorrow afternoon? So there I was, getting the 10 bus up to the Phoenix Park, brought in. And I was hugely impressed with Mr. De Valera. We were received with silver teapots and lovely sandwiches. And he was supposed to spend half an hour with us, but he spent well over an hour, and he had incredible charm. Then the next day, all of the papers, they used to have social and personal in those days, and they all carried the thing. The president yesterday at Oros and Uachtaráin received Mr. Maurice Manning. The Times and the Indo said from Bagnallstown, the Irish Press said from Unibiog, and Miss Susan Waddle from Minneapolis, Minnesota. But it didn't have a happy ending. The poet still won.
Oh.
So there we were.
Yeah. Great story, though. We're in the midst of such important anniversaries. You are chairperson, aren't you? The decade of centenaries. How is that a stressful job? And how important do you think it is to look back? And how difficult is it to get them balanced, certainly the ones coming up?
It's gone very well. It's been a great learning curve, I think, for the nation in coming to terms with how we commemorate events that can be very divisive and potentially very traumatic for people. And it's worked very well, largely, I think, Miriam, because the people have changed. Irish people can now look at these events, for the most part, as history, not as part of current political debate. And so 1916, the commemorations there were wonderful and everybody got involved, and it was a hugely unifying series of events. We're now coming up to the difficult ones, War of Independence, which can be difficult. Many Church of Ireland people say are very worried about some of the events being commemorated. We're coming into the Civil War, where what we're saying is two things, really. There should just be one great national ceremony of commemoration and reconciliation. And then that local people, because we're putting a strong emphasis on local people, they should be able to organise their own affairs. But we're also saying the archives should be fully opened up. Let the historians in. Let the full truth be told, you know, and let the bits fall where they may. But also we're hoping that, you know, the arts and culture communities and RTE will be involved in the way they were for 1916, in trying to find suitable ways, appropriate ways of remembering.
Because it's, and when you're as chair of it, as running it, you mentioned there obviously some Church of Ireland people can be concerned. How do you assuage those fears and worries? How does one do that?
Well, we meet and talk and listen. We work very closely with the Department of Arts and Culture, which, in my experience, is a superb department. I worked especially closely with Heather Humphreys, who was a great minister. But we talk and listen, and I don't think people are setting out to hurt other people. And they're making space for each other. And there's a huge interest locally, and the local authorities played a great part in making it a success. And I think they will do the same. And the whole decade will end. The foundation of the state will be commemorated by the handover in Dublin Castle to Michael Collins, which is a very dramatic event as he walks in and power is effectively handed over. But it's going to end in with Ireland entering the League of Nations in 1923, which will be a very fitting end for the decade.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose an historian in your role now, I suppose it gives you time as well, even more so, to look back at these, I suppose, extraordinary people who devised the first Dáil, wrote our constitution, pushed our country forward. Do you look back with great affection for the
well,
people?
Well, I do, of course, and understanding. But I was very lucky, Miriam. My first book, The Blue Shirts, and I was only nearly in short trousers when I was writing it. It was way back in the 60s. But The Blue Shirts was only 30 years before that. For me, in my 20s, 30 years could be a century.
Yeah, of course.
But so I was able to meet virtually all of the people of that time. I'd go around, I'd just ring up or write. And I thought these would be awesome figures. But in fact, most of them now were middle-aged men, delighted to talk to somebody who was interested in them and even pour a glass of whiskey, which I...
Our list this morning, David Farrell actually says, lovely to hear, of course, himself being a prof now at UCD. Lovely to hear the dulcet tones of Maurice Manning on Miriam, one of the nicest, more supportive of friends and colleagues, a national treasure. And just to say, David's father, Brian Farrell, who I had the privilege of working for, I would also say he was a beautiful man. Back to David, yeah.
Yeah, I was very lucky. Brian was my first colleague at UCD. My UCD years, I really, really enjoyed. And Brian and I were appointed on the same day. He as a senior lecturer. And it was a great, great friendship. No, he was wonderful.
Another listener, Alfie, says, Miriam, say to Morris, I'm listening to him on your show and I recall his dad ordering a Morris Minor as a Christmas present for his mother, who was such a lovely woman. That's why I love live radio.
That's very funny. My mother, that Morris Minor, she was probably...
she liked it, obviously.
Oh, yeah, but she was probably the worst driver in County Carlow. I mean, she didn't believe in gears or things like that.
And John Donegan from Charleville says, please convey my regards and best wishes to Morris Manning and his wife. Interestingly, last week we had on a congressman. Let's listen to him now. And he was talking about his mother, right?
Yes.
And he was talking about how his mother died from an illness called hemochromatosis, which I know you have yourself. And he did this shout out last week. Let's listen now to Brian.
By the way, I hope everyone listening gets tested for hemochromatosis, which unfortunately afflicts our people. It's sometimes jokingly referred to as the Celtic curse, because we are 10 times more likely to be carriers, and that was one of the contributing factors for my mom. So if you excuse the public service announcement, it's an important issue to try to raise awareness.
Yeah, no, that's important. And interestingly, Morris, and someone else has just tweeted, great, Miriam, that you're going to talk about the Celtic curse, which is hemochromatosis. You have it. What is it? Now, it can be really serious.
Simple terms, you've got too much iron in your blood. And it happens. And the iron accumulates. It can lodge in your liver and give you cirrhosis. It can lodge in your heart and give you heart congestion. And while you have it, it can make life very uncomfortable. You have aches and pains and so on. And what is so annoying about the way it's treated here is that it's the easiest illness, disease, to diagnose. We're particularly susceptible to Celtic curses, it's called, but a simple blood test will tell you if you have it. And if you have it, you can get treatment, which really is giving blood, if you get it in time. If it goes too long, now I was diagnosed with diabetes in about 2001, and had a wonderful GP, Paul Casey, and he said, "No, I want to find out more," so he put me for further tests, and they showed I had hemochromatosis, and you're supposed to have about 100 units of ferritin in your system. I had about 4,000. I mean, if I walked near a magnet, it would have grabbed me, I think. It was, but if I hadn't been diagnosed, I'd be dead now. It's as simple as that. And that's why I feel so passionate about telling other people.
Yeah, because if you diagnose it, you're fine. Look at you look really healthy.
I've been very lucky, yeah. But I mean, I had to go about a couple of years of treatment. But it was very manageable and very doable. But Margaret Mullett, who really runs the hemochromatosis,
she's a wonderful woman,
is a fantastic person. And she's been battling almost a one-person battle. And I really wish that the department, they break your hearts, the HSE. They're so bureaucratic in their dealings with them. We only got one meeting with them. There were three of us there. 14 of them turned up with flip charts and patronising platitudes. I mean, I won't go on because I'd say things. Right. But I mean, I really wish it could become a priority, because people's lives could be saved, and saved cheaply.
An awareness campaign. Lots of reaction. I'll let you go. Morris Manning and Brian Fowler were so kind and helpful to their students 40 years ago. That's from Turlick. Another said, Morris Manning inspired so many of his students in UCD. A real gentleman who's genuinely interested in his students. Great to hear him on Miriam this morning. Last one to you, Morris. My grandmother, says this listener called Michael Farrell. Don't know which Michael Farrell, could be the real one. My grandmother lived on Station Road in Bagnallstown. Yes. Always regarded Morris's dad as a master craftsman and was very proud of the many beautifully crafted pieces of his furniture in her house.
Yes.
Fantastic. Morris Manning, go on. You want to say one thing?
Nope.
Right. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks.
Stay well, and best of luck with all the centenaries coming up. Thanks so much.
Very
we'll
much.
Take a break.
Thank you.
Well, last Thursday night, 38 years after the tragedy at the Stardust nightclub in Artane in North County Dublin, which took 48 young lives, and it remains the worst tragedy in the history of this state. Well, their families and friends, they gathered to remember their loved ones who had died in the fire. First, let's hear now how the fire was reported on the news the morning after.
At least 40 people have died in a fire which destroyed the Stardust Club at Artane in Dublin early this morning. More than 100 people have been taken to hospital, many of them suffering from serious burns and other injuries.
Well, joining me this morning are Christine Keegan, who lost her two beautiful daughters, Mary and Martina, and her other daughter, Antoinette, is also here with her this morning. Antoinette was there on the night but survived it. And we're also joined this morning by Eugene Kelly, who lost his younger brother, Robert, known as Spikey. Thanks so much to all three of you for coming in.
Thank you for having us on the show, Miriam.
Oh, I'm delighted. Sure, I interviewed you back in 1985, we were just talking about, and you're still fighting all this time on.
That's right.
It's amazing.
You're at my mother and father's house, and you're doing a programme, I think it was out of court or something.
Yeah, the BBC.
Yeah, and that was in 85.
It's amazing.
And then my father passed away then in 1986, only 49 years of age.
It just reminded me of how long you've all been fighting for justice and telling your story. Look, it's been a very difficult week. For you, first of all, Christine, and your daughters, what was Thursday evening like when you were remembering them last Thursday? What was that like for you?
Oh, I never talk about the children in the house because the younger ones now didn't know the time. You know what I mean? They didn't know the full story.
You're 82 now, aren't you?
83.
83?
Yeah, yeah.
Eugene, was Thursday remembering everything important for you?
It brought it all back there, Miriam. I get a cold feeling when I get down to the status. Like, you know, all the anniversaries over the years we've been going down, myself and Anthony and the rest of the committee on board. We get as much people down just to show respect to the loss of our loved ones there where he passed away. And I just like to see, because I read my brother's cardinals report and there was nothing left of my brother, arms, legs and all missing. And I'm the only one who's seen the cardinals report with my ex-partner. And I had many, many nightmares and I want to know the truth. There was never any verdict on my brother's death and I want to get to the bottom of the truth. And I'm going away till I get the truth.
Listen, let's go back. Antoinette, you were there on the night. Remind people this morning, because I think it's 38 years, and for a lot of people even this morning, they will have forgotten the story in its detail. Tell you and your two sisters had it off. Tell me about them, and tell me about Mary and Martina.
Well, it was Friday the 13th, 1981, and there was a big event going on, KTEL, a disco competition, and everybody was talking about it. We were all looking forward to it. It was a big build-up to it. And myself and my sisters went. What we had to do, like everyone had to do, going to the Stardust, you literally had to separate yourself, right? If you wanted to get in with your friends, say three of us would go first and then another three go behind two other people, because nearly every second lot of people was stopped and said no, to get refused. So in order for us all to get in, that's the way we had to do.
Just because it was so busy.
Yeah. And it was a big event. Like, there was so many people going to be refused. Like, my brother John was refused that night. So my mother would have four of us in it if he had got in.
Because he would have left without getting the whole lot out.
Yeah, he was told he was too young. He was 17. My sister Martina, she was 16. My other sister Mary was 19. And I was 18. But we got in, we paid our £3. We got our ticket for the meal. And the night was going very, very well. It was a great event. Disco competition was on. The winners was announced. And then we were, like, all up on the floor dancing. And my friend said to me, look over there. There's a small fire. But when I looked over, it was only a small fire, but I seen the smoke coming across the ceiling. And I thought the DJ was at the letting special effects off. And next of all, right, the DJ made an announcement. There's a small fire here. Everything is under control. We have everything under control. Don't panic. The next thing was another announcement. Can everybody please make their way to the exits? But after that then, right, people rushing to get out because the fire was actually coming down on top of us. The small fire was still on the sea, but the whole roof was caving in on top of us. The ceiling was coming down and the fire was on top of us. It was thick black smoke and the heat with the choking in your throat and you couldn't breathe and all your top part of your body was getting burned and you're holding your hands on your head and trying to protect yourself. But with the rush of people trying to get out, myself and my two sisters was pushed to the ground with my friends. We were trampled on and we couldn't get up because people were rushing, running over us, trying to get out. And as we lay on the ground, I just said, oh God, please help us, help us. And the next thing I knew, I was gone, unconscious. And then I was outside in a different atmosphere. A fella had seen me wearing my sister's white blouse and pulled me out. And I was rubbing my hands and screaming the pain. I kept shouting, where's Mary and Martine? And an ambulance man said to me, everybody's out, they're all out, they're gone to the hospitals. And I was the last person getting into the ambulance. I said, I'm going home. He said, you have to get in the ambulance, you have to get in. So when I got in the ambulance, went to all the different hospitals. We went to the Mater, the Maid, Jervis Street, the whole lot, every one of the hospitals. And as we were approaching them, the porters had their hands up saying, we're full. So the ambulance had to keep driving and driving and driving. And I remember the girl that was sitting beside me on this, the right, she was on my right hand side. I was beside the door. Her head just flopped onto my right shoulder. And that's the way I stayed all the way in. I was afraid to look. I don't know whether she was dead, but that she just stayed on my right shoulder, didn't move. And I was terrified to even look. I was like, still kind of like, oh, what's that happening here? It was like being in hell. Eventually, we got to Dr. Stevens's hospital, and that was the last hospital that we ended up getting to, that they took us in. I was put in a kind of a cubicle on a stretcher, and I was banging my hands off the, between the walls. My two hands was banging because they were stinging me and my face, and I was couldn't breathe, and I kept saying, hey, please help me, I can't breathe. So eventually I was brought into a ward, and I was put on a life support machine because my lungs had been very badly damaged. One lung had totally collapsed and the other lung was severely smoke damaged. And I remember just like lying there and looking and seeing people like all burned beside me, opposite me, and it was just horrible. And then I kept saying, I want to talk to my ma, I want my dad. And eventually my ma and dad, after going through all the hospitals, came and found me, but they walked past me. They didn't recognise me, and I kept saying, ma, ma. And then my ma looked and she goes, and then I knew by my dad's face and my ma's face that I must be really bad. They didn't even know who I was. And I just kept asking, where's Mary and Martina? And he said, they're fine, they're fine. 2.5 weeks I spent in Dr. Stevens's hospital, and my mother and father came up after burying Mary and Martina on the 18th of February, came up to see me for 2.5 weeks. And I'd asked them, how's Mary? How's Martina? And they said, they're fine. Mary's in the Mater, Martina's in the Maid. They were asking for you. They took off their mourning clothes, removed them, came up in their ordinary clothes for 2.5 weeks to keep me alive, pretending that Mary and Martina was alive, but they were actually dead.
Because they were so worried, you were so ill.
That the doctors had told not to say anything to me because I'd go into shock. And I wasn't allowed a newspaper, I wasn't allowed a radio, I wasn't allowed to look at the television. And anyone that came up to see me had to tell me Mary and Martina was okay.
Christine, was that a very difficult time for you when you were going to visit Antoinette? And obviously you couldn't let her know that your other two daughters were dead.
No, couldn't. And to put her back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
And I didn't know what to be saying to her. I said, maybe I'll open my mouth and say something wrong. I'll walk myself into it.
Mm. How did you first hear about the fire, Christine? Is it true that your husband, John, who I met actually in 85, but he was working in Cadbury's factory during the night,
yeah,
and someone said to him, there's been a terrible fire at the Stardust. Is that what happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't wait to tell the boss that he was gone. He just run out.
And then did he wake you up, Christine?
Yeah.
He actually knew when he got home, because it was always a rule in the home, right? The last one in turn off the porch light. And when he got drove home to the house, he seen the porch light was still on. And he ran up the stairs and he said, Chrissy, get up, get up. And he always had a policy never to go into the girls' room, because as we were getting older, he used to say, no, I'm not going in, that's their privacy. But he said, go in and see if the girls are there. He went into the boys' room and my brother was there, and he said, Mary and Martin and Anthony, where are they? And my brother said, I don't know, I was refused. Now, my brother didn't even know that there had been a fire. He knew nothing about it. And with that then, my ma went in to check on us, and three beds empty, because we had bunk beds and the three of them were empty. And that's when they went down to the Stardust, and the police was down there telling you can't go near here, you can't go. Like, my mother always says it, the ground was still roasting her. It was still burning when she got down there.
Christine, how did you find out, yourself and John, your husband, that Mary and Martina had died in the fire? Can you remember when you found that out? Was it? I know you went around lots of the hospitals looking for them, didn't you, Christine?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I couldn't find them. That's where they're in the city, Marco.
And that's in the end how you found out? What about you, Eugene? When did you find out about your brother Robert?
Well, I was a seaman like Robert. Robert was 17, and it's a really coincidence the way it happened. Robert worked on the ship. He was on the Rosslare for the B&I on weekend, for a week on, week off. He's Tuesday to Tuesday, and ship broke down on the Thursday, and he ended up the status with his friends on the Friday, which if the ship hadn't have broke down, he wouldn't have been there. But I was the same man myself, and the ship sailed into Dublin the Saturday morning. I got word to the ship stating that Eugene has been firing the status last night. A lot of people gone missing. Word got shipped that you've got to get home straight away. So one of the lads off the ship drove me home, because he wouldn't let me go, because I went into a state, like, you know. Mm. Because I seen me mother always went down to hospitals, and Robert hadn't been found. So as soon as I got home, she was walking through the door. My mother was crying. She said, Eugene, Robert is dead. I know he's dead. And I said, look, Ma, we don't know yet. We just have to wait to see what the outcome is, like, you know. It's early stages, yeah. So during the week, myself and the sister was going in and out of the morgue, and then I can recall one of the guards, she kind of came out with a bit of a velvet jacket, which I was aware it was Robert's clothing. And I identified it, and I knew straight away. She said, yeah, well, Robert, we have him in their state, and he was having me. So I just recall, I just collapsed, and I just recall getting taken home in police care. And I have to be honest with you, Miriam, as soon as I came through them doors, my mother was lying in bed, and soon she heard me roaring, screaming, roaring, crying. She knew Robert was dead. And it's a day I'll never forget. I'll never forget the day, because I was so close to Robert. He was like my best friend, because he'd done anything for me and I'd do anything for him. He was my favourite brother among them all. I'm not ashamed to turn around and say he was my favourite. It broke my heart. And I'd many, since I've seen his coroner's report, I'm being honest, I'm getting emotional with him. There was nothing left of him. There was nothing left of my brother. And I want the people to be responsible for this. And I want to get a closure once and for all for all these families. I'm looking at that lady, my neighbour, and all three, Mrs. McDermott, God bless her. She's not even well today. We need a closure once and for all. I'm looking at these women and going out on journeys with these for the last 18, 20 years. It's a disgrace, Miriam, that they're fighting to get, use their own money to get closure once and for all. And I'm pleading with the government that's in power today, I'm pleading with them, give us a closure once and for all and let these women get on with their lives. Because from day one, since 1981, they had no lives, no more than I had. And I think it's about time these people that's in power today, let us get justice once and for all. They're in power, and do the decent thing and get a closure with these families. People have voted these in, and let them come on the journey with us, hear their case, find out what's going on. It's there, the evidence is there. And as far as I'm concerned, put their hands up.
Because to explain to people, there was a tribunal set up the following year, and in the end of it, there was a lack of evidence, everyone says. So they came up with a decision, Justice Ronan Keane, that it was probably arson. And since then, there have been so many experts. I know there have been documentaries done by Rita O'Reilly in Primetime, Charlie Bird. And there's lots of evidence with new fire officers saying, in fact, it was most likely not arson. So you want another inquiry, don't you, Antoinette?
Miriam, what we're looking for is the inquest to be reopened. We've had three inquiries. Ronan Keane in 1982 and came back with probable arson.
Yeah.
Now, the Garda never believed it was arson. We've seen the guy at the file, and they never believed it was arson. So I don't know where this probable arson came from, but it stood on the record for 27 years. And then Paul Coffey came along, and he said for the government to find the means of removing it or else give another inquiry. So the government decided then 27 years later to remove arson. But for 27 years, 841 people, including 48 victims that went to their grave, were branded arsonists. That's what we were left with. The state left us in that position because they gave the probable arson theory. And I can't understand when Paul Coffey...
Who is Paul Coffey?
He's the senior counsel. He was the eminent legal person that was employed to do the independent examination into the Stardust to see if we're going to get a new inquiry. When he recommended that be removed, and it was agreed with the Dáil and the Seanad, there was an obligation on the state then to initiate a criminal investigation, because this wasn't only just about a building that went on fire. This was about 48 young people that lost their lives. And still to this day, there's nobody held accountable for the deaths of 48 victims.
When did you find out, Antoinette, that Mary and Martina were dead? Because actually we spoke a little while ago to your mum. Obviously they tried to protect you. You were in hospital. Mm. You were so ill. How did you find out your sisters had died?
Like I said, I was 2.5 weeks in Dr. Stevens's hospital, and one day a priest came in and he just came over to me and said, hi, and I said, hi. He said, what's your name? I said, Antoinette Keegan. And he went, oh, that's right. He said, you lost your two sisters. And I said, no, I didn't. Oh, you did? He said, you did. I said, no, I didn't. I said, my ma and dad told me they're in the matter in the maid. And he said, no, they're dead, they're dead. And I screamed the hospital down, and then my dad and my ma walked in and see me upset it was. But I see me dad when he came in, and he was seeing my eyes, I was at being roared and crying. And he said, I said, why did you just lie to me? Why did you just tell me a lie? And my dad says, what? And I says, a priest started telling me, I said, Mary and Martina are dead. And my dad went, what? And he ran all over the hospital looking for the priest. And he came back, he said, I can't find him, he said. But he said, he shouldn't have said that to you. But I don't think the priest realised, I don't think he'd done it out of any malice or any harm.
No, I wouldn't say he did.
No, he probably thought you knew.
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah. But after that then, like, I just wanted to get out of the hospital. I wanted so much. And I remember I had a night dress on me, and like the ward was like kind of empty, and I was at getting up. I walked down the corridor, and I walked down the stairwell, right down, and I ended up on the quay, just about on the quay. I wanted to jump in the liffey after I heard all that, and a porter got me back up. I wanted to just jump in the liffey and die. I felt so guilty that I got out, and Mary and Martina were killed. And even years after, right, I tried so many things to kill myself because the guilt feeling that was there, taking overdose of tablets and slit my wrist, it was just, it was horrible. And literally, I have to get a lot stronger for the sake of my mother because I want to keep her alive. Mm. Like, I lost my father, my two sisters, and I don't want to lose my ma. I know someday I'm going to lose her, but I have to keep fighting for justice for her because she wants it and she deserves it. 38 years is too long to be waiting for. And all the other families as well. Mrs. McDermott, Mrs. Barrett, Mrs. Bissett, Mrs. McHugh lost their only child. Their only child. Heartbreaking it is.
I'm just struck by how desperately unhappy and traumatised 30 years on you all still are. And, you know, I say that with such sadness. And
well, I think, Miriam, the reason why we want to meet the Taoiseach is the Taoiseach of this country is representing all these people in this country. He's been brought within. We've been suffering all down the years since 1981.
I can see that.
And yeah. we want what we're actually looking for. We're actually looking for the truth. I want to know what was the cause of my brother's death and the 47 who died with him. We deserve this. My brother didn't deserve to go into a club there and pay £3 and come out like gold dust, like dust, as far as I'm concerned. Ricardo, as far as I know, fire brigade men, they were doing picking up body parts that night. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not quite 100% sure if my brother is actually down there, because the fire officers actually stated in a documentary we done, they were picking up body parts. So, to my knowledge, where have these body parts gone? And which box had they gone into? And my brother's called me to report me, and there was nothing left of him. He was just the teeth.
Have you managed to live?
No.
Since
just
now.
Surviving. I had many of nightmares. And recall of Anthony's talking about Norbert. I was taken in. I was a seaman, and we used to be given duty free. And I used to get, I got a full bottle of Pernod. And I actually took that with tablets after when Robert was pronounced dead. And I was driving straight into Jervis Street Hospital and pumped out. And I can recall the doctor saying to my friend, another few minutes and your friend was dead. Everything just went through your mind. You just go into a blank. And I want to see that nobody has got, we can't get counselling at the moment till we get closure. And I want closure for these families. I want to see these ladies, Mrs. McDermott. She's not well at the moment, that poor woman. She wasn't even down there towards tonight.
And she lost two daughters.
She lost two sons and a daughter. Yeah. And I want to see that woman get justice. I've cried with these women going out on the journey, getting these cards in. And the poor woman, Mrs. McDermott, and I'm looking, I'm tears running out of my eyes to see her going around the pavilion and sword and begging these people, will you sign this form, sign this form. It's a disgrace. We shouldn't be doing this, Miriam. This should have been closed up years ago. I'm calling on the teacher today.
Sign them. Get them signed.
Yeah, I'm calling on the teacher today to meet our legal team and the committee, and we can give them more of an indication which direction we're going.
It is very important that we meet the Taoiseach. Now, I've sent several emails in. I've had Tommy Brown asking him in the Dáil, Richard By Barra, Denise Mitchell asked, and several asked there on Thursday, or Friday, or Thursday while we were outside doing the Candlelight Vigil, we were outside the Dáil, and they did ask in the Dáil, right, when will you meet them? But we're not getting any response. I'd like to ask the Taoiseach, what is the problem with meeting us? We're human beings.
Our final question. Would it make much of a difference, though, if there was another inquiry? I mean, it won't bring back your Mary and Martina. Sure, it won't, Antoinette.
No.
It won't make you less traumatised.
Miriam, we're not even looking for any more inquiries, because we have three inquiries there. We have the first one, we have the second one, and then we have Pat McCartan one.
Yeah.
Three different conclusions. We're looking for the inquest to be reopened, like what Hillsborough got and Bloody Sunday got. We're looking for the same as what they got, and that's our human rights. We are entitled to have a proper verdict. Under Section 24 of the 1962 Coroner's Act, we should have had a proper verdict. A medical verdict is not a verdict. You have to, there's so many different verdicts, as you know, Miriam, and we haven't got that. But the law has been broken.
Well, look, thank you to the three of you for coming in. I know how traumatising it is all these years on, and I'm so sorry you're all still so upset about it. Eugene, Christine, Antoinette, I hope you get what you're seeking. Thanks all very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mary. Can I just say one final thing? We have a great legal team on board. We have Darren Mackin, and he's our solicitor. And we also have the forensic pathologist from the Grenfell Terrace. And we also have the barrister from Hillsborough. So we feel, right, that we really, really need to see the Taoiseach, because the application for the Attorney General is in its finalisation now at this moment while I'm talking. It's almost complete. There's just one or two little things that we put in. So we need to have a meeting and ask the Taoiseach questions while we're preparing this application. It's very, very important that we meet him ASAP.
Eugene, Christine, Antoinette, thanks so much for coming in this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And so much reaction there to your interviews. I'll just bring you three. One, because Martin Fraser obviously lost his sister. Every time I go to the site where my sister lost her life, he says, I'm overcome with emotion. It's a place where many, many hearts were shattered beyond belief. It's a place where 38 years on, the brokenhearted family members and friends come to try to make sense of it all. Another from a midwife on the night. I was a student midwife in the Coombe that night. I'll never forget the sadness over the city as news
news emerged. We were all about the same age then. So very sad. That's from Breda Gahan. And one more. I'll just bring you one because I couldn't bring you even half of them. Thank you to your Stardust survivors here this morning for having the strength to tell their stories. It's hard to hear, but how so much harder for them to tell. So important. They must get the inquiry and answers. And that's what virtually everyone is sending us in today.